Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. There's such big stuff this week that James Carville and I have to do it alone. So you guys just stick with us, will you? Remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. Now, we're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Real Paper, Miracle Made, and Lomi, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors because it really helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. James Carville, I keep thinking the 2024 presidential contest will start to look better, or at least a little bit less dark. I'm still waiting. No poll these days is a shocker after so many, but the Wall Street Journal survey last month, last weekend, seemed even worse. Biden was behind by, I think, 4 in a two-way race and 6 in a multi-candidate field. That's not especially new, but more worrisome, almost twice as many voters think they did better economically under Trump than they have under Biden. Now, that's demonstrably untrue, but it doesn't matter what I think. It's what voters think. And another survey showed among black voters, 17% were going to vote for Trump, double what it was in 2020. The intensity of the Jewish-Palestinian issue in this country, especially among young voters, cost Biden, as he did well with both. So, James, a very simple request. Walk me off this cliff.
So, Al, as you know and well aware, well documented on this show, I have been highly skeptical of the idea of President Biden running for re-election. And to be fair to you, my partner and co-host, you have shared that same skepticism that I have. I have to tell you that I think during the last half of this year, the cowardness in the Democratic consultant community, elected official community, Democratic influencer people has been so evident, it's staggering. It's breathtaking. So now I'm hearing, well, you might have been right in June, but there's nothing we can do about it. Okay, I profoundly disagree. But and to be fair, in the access crowd, the crowd that, you know, just sits back and won't say a thing. And now saying, well, the economic numbers are starting to dig a little deeper, and there's some, you know, we're starting to see some income growth, and, you know, we're going to see some lower prices. And if you just wait, it could turn out well. Okay, maybe. And that assumes that all of the concerns about President Biden are economic, which is, to me, a pretty big leap to make. But I got to tell you, Albert, the excuses that people use to put what is their own self-interest against the interests of the country, and I want to be very clear here, that is happening over and over again. We're risking the long-term future of the United States. And believe me, I'm not exaggerating. It'll be the end of the Constitution. But we can't say anything because maybe I won't have the access that I had before. And look, the White House plays very hard with these people. You know, they'll cut you off in a second. Everybody knows that. But I just have to say, what I think when this is all said and done, there's been a massive failure of what you call it, establishment, a lead, or high end, or I don't know, stupid words. I don't know how to describe it, but in the upper echelons of the Democratic Party, if you ask me to have one word to describe it, it would be cowardness.
Yeah, no, it's hard to take issue with that. You know, I find even to me, I am even more confounded by Trump's continuing strength, at least vis-a-vis Biden. I think other Democrats could beat him. But I, you know, I'll write off 36% to die-in-the-wool Republicans, racist, and some with legitimate grievances. But today, after all the sins he committed as president, 91 charges, 4 indictments, top officials saying he'd be dangerous to the country, he's up at 45. And I don't know, James, is there anything that can stop him? Criminal conviction or something that would turn it around? Because that worries me. The case is going to the Supreme Court about his claim that he's above the law, and all the precedent is in favor of Jack Smith, the special prosecutor. But with this court, you can't bet on that.
You cannot, you know, I've seen legal people, but they know more than I do, but I don't know how much they know about it. Some people think the Supreme Court will not go along with Trump on this. I don't know, but I think there's stuff piling up. And, you know, a lot is going to depend on Iowa and New Hampshire. If they don't make some kind of breakthrough, which I have to confess is increasingly problematic. This is a conversation that has gone on, political consultant shit, since I can remember, is what is the base Democratic? There are two numbers in the Wall Street Journal poll that jumped out at me. First, in a multi-candidate field, an incumbent Democratic president gets 31.
Yeah.
I can't begin to tell you what that is. There is no historical precedent under any trial heat vote that just with the Democratic label, in addition to being an incumbent president, in addition, in my opinion, has done a stellar job with, you know, helping every part of the base, particularly Black voters. And the numbers continue to be abysmal. 31. There was another thing that grabbed me. And when you look at polls as long as I have, you're always looking for something to see, well, maybe the people that did it were kind of asleep. They weren't paying attention. They just came in with a view, and just everything that fit that view, they would answer it. So in the head-to-head with Trump, which it will not be a head-to-head on Election Day, but let's do that,
right?
Because that's the headline number. I think Biden was down 6.
He was down 4, I think, in the head-to-head, and down 6 in the multi.
Down 4 in the head-to-head. Okay. Ron DeSantis and Biden were 45-45. So that tells you that the respondent is hearing things, correct?
It does.
Nikki Haley versus Biden, now, this doesn't even seem possible, is 51-36, 17 points. Maybe it was 34. I think it was 34. 17 points.
Yeah, I think it was.
Even with one, -4 with another, -17 with another. If that doesn't convince you that these respondents were paying attention to the questions that they were being asked, then there's nothing I can do to convince you. But that was, to me, the most breathtaking, instructive number in the entire poll. So in a multi-candidate field, the incumbent Democrat gets 31. In a head-to-head, you get 34. Somebody please tell me how these are not disastrous numbers. Please tell me. I want to know. I want to get off of this. I want to fall in line. I want to be part of the team. But no one can give me any reason to do it other than, well, the hell, it's too late. What chicken shit, people? Good God, save
me.
Oh,
James, I'm still on that cliff. I may even have taken a step further. You know, the Supreme Court is going to hear Jack Smith's appeal. Trump is basically claiming he's above the law. I mean, the law doesn't matter. And the court's going to hear another case in addition to this one, which was brought, that says, can the government charge defendants with a law that makes it a crime to corruptly obstruct an official congressional proceeding? If they go the way they might go on that and side with the Republicans, that's going to jeopardize a number of cases, maybe including Trump's. You know, our friend Walter Dellinger used to say, you know, this court, you got to understand, it's a Republican. It's a conservative court. It's not a Trump court. So he wasn't surprised back in 21 when they sided with the Manhattan DA, or 20, and they sided with Congress and turning over records. That's because yesterday, to these Republican justices, Trump was yesterday. Now he's today, tomorrow. And I think that this case, the Jack Smith case, should be easy. I think the obstruction charge case should be easy. With this court, nothing is easy, James.
Yeah, I mean, I, you know, nobody has can, yeah, my respect for Walt is deep and profound, but I did have to point out he didn't think that Dobbs would overturn Roe, but it's one vote. But okay, you know, yeah. I understand that. But on most questions before the court, he's probably, and things I've heard him call, he's 14 for 15.
I wish he were still around because he'd be, you know, right? 25 for 26 now.
Yeah. Oh, God. There's a, for every, on every front, not just the legal front, on sports, on culture,
yeah,
on politics, on, I mean, the guy was a, like a polymath like no other I have ever known. And I can't spend enough time talking about Walter, but I don't, you know, I can't guess what they're going to do. But, you know, they're taking up a lot of different cases. You know, look at this, we should talk about this New York redistricting. They're going to have to go through intellectual contusions.
I don't think the High Court will do that, James. They've been very loath to strike down redistrictings, mainly because it's helped Republicans.
I agree, but that's going to cost the Republicans a shitload.
Just as North Carolina costs the Democrats a shitload.
Right, and they can do a lot of intellectual pretzels. I would tend to think that they won't because they've been so adamant about this. But I don't know. And I don't think that they really like Trump. I think that Gorsuch and Kavanaugh and Barrett at some level are embarrassed by it, that they're forever associated with being put on the court by Trump. But that's just my thought. Maybe I'm projecting my values on theirs.
James, you know that I turn to you sometimes to fill in my gaps, but I have to say you really let me down a few weeks ago when I asked you, on what grounds are the House Republicans trying to impeach Joe Biden? They're closer now, but have you found that elusive evidence or basis for that impeachment?
I keep looking
somewhere.
I mean, I got like Sherlock Holmes with, you know, some
weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
And I tell you, the guy who I listened to on this is a radio show by the name of Dan Abrams. He's a legal analyst from ABC. He is not a left winger at all. Not at all. And he just has repeatedly said, I don't see any evidence at all connecting Joe Biden to any of this. Please help me. And so I try to tune in to Dan just to see if there's something new, because he keeps looking for it. And he says, look, I'm happy to admit that I'm wrong. And of course, this thing they had with Hunter showing up to testify in Coma and Jim Jordan, I just keep repeating this, and you know, said it early. And sometimes people like to brag and say, you see, I told you so. Well, you see, I told you so. They're not very smart people. They're really not very smart people. And how, why does the Republican Party, why didn't somebody say, what are we going to do about this shit show we have of these congressional committees? We keep promising our voters something and we never deliver. The roles were reversed, the criticism among Democrats would be bitter and mad. Like, what are you people doing? What are we sending you from Washington for, to sit there and just make fools of yourself and fools of us? I don't think this is, but on the other hand, that we would, the Democrats would act the same way for this kind of stupidity that the Republicans react to stupidity.
Well, you're absolutely right. Whether you agree or disagree on the whole process of impeachment, the Democrats in each case had a very strong case. I mean, basically with Ukraine, Trump tried to shake down a foreign government to deliver dirt on his opponent. Now, you may decide presidents can do anything, and that's not impeachable, but certainly that you can make a strong case that it is. And certainly you can make a strong case that inciting the January 6th riot was an impeachable offense. Again, whether you agree with it or not, there ain't nothing here. I mean, there's blue smoke and mirrors, and I'm not even sure you got the blue smoke.
Well, every chin scratcher says you got to realize impeachment is a political process. I mean, that's always the first thing that comes out. It's not a judicial process. All right, that's a political process. But why are you not offended? And let's assume, just for the what is the word to use in law school? Arguendo or something? It sounds like some kind of fucking Latin word.
You're our law school graduate.
That it's all political. It's all political. Okay. Well, the political buffoonery on their side is breathtaking. I mean, all right, if you're going to play politics, I think the Democrats play, I disagree, but you can say, okay, I think Democrats play politics by imagine taking offense of holding up a congressionally mandated spending in order to dig up dirt on your opponent. It seems to me to be, you know, inciting a insurrection on a United States Capitol. Okay, that I'm kind of convinced, but maybe you say that's all political. They can't even play the political part. If I just gave them every point, you're still idiots. Why do you tolerate this incompetence and tomfoolery? I don't know. I don't have the answer. I'd love to get one.
I think you're not getting it because it's not there, James. Let me turn to another congressional event this week. The hearings on anti-Semitism, supposedly at Harvard, University of Pennsylvania, and MIT, they were, in the vernacular, a shit show. First, the Ivy League leaders might have been well prepared for a courtroom. They were not prepared for a political gunfight, and they blew it when they replied, genocide had to be taken in context. No, it really does not. If they had been prepared, not just by good lawyers, but by people like Phil Schillero, the best congressional investigator I've ever known, Stephanie Cutter, Jennifer Palmieri, experts in political communications, they would have known what was coming. They would have perhaps been prepared. It came mainly from a New York congresswoman, Elise Stefanik, who, A, is smart, B, is totally unprincipled. In 2019, she switched from the leader of the moderate Republicans in the House to become a fanatical MAGA Trump supporter and has stayed there because that's the way she sees the winds blowing in her party. And see, she's out for blood against Harvard, which in 2021 kicked her off an advisory board for lying. You know, I think if you're on an advisory board in an academic institution and you're lying, you ought to be kicked off. But the lesson here, and I think those presidents did a horrible job, is the next time you're in a knife fight, bring a knife.
Well, I have to say this, that according to news reports and according to independent research, the chief lawyer for the Penn and Harvard presidents was a woman named Alyssa DeCuna. You can look her up. She's a big-time lawyer at a big-time law firm called WilmerHale, which is a big-time law firm. And they rejected political advice. This I know. In fact, one of the people that you mentioned had like offered it. And I am not convinced that this whole thing was not a trap set up by the lawyers for Harvard and Penn. And, you know, there are plenty of answers. Which, you know, is really funny, as a mutual friend of ours said something and asked the head of Hillel, which is the Jewish student community. They're all over. There's one big one at Tulane. You've got one, every university has that. And said, they don't, when they say the river to the sea, they don't even know what river they're talking about. It's just some sloganeering that some idiotic 19-year-olds would yell in colonialism and not knowing anything about it. I mean, these are kids that can take a standardized test. And honestly, not much ability to think beyond that. But the fact that these university leaders got up there and were so politically buffonic, is that a word?
It sounds like it, because they certainly were that.
It sounds like it should be. If it's not a word,
you can do that and it fits.
I, you know, it's a trap. that they walked into an ambush. I don't think it was even coordination with Democratic members of the committee or Democratic staff. I didn't see any preparation that there was a kind of space that you went back to. I didn't see any of that. I don't. There's no evidence, as anybody sane would do. You'd set up a mock committee room. You would have lawyers. You would have political operatives. You'd have like Phil Schlero. You'd have people that had run congressional committees and say, okay, this is a picture. This is Elise Stefanik. This is where she's going, who she is. This is where she's going to be coming from. All right. And you can, if you want to, you can side twice about pointing out that Harvard fired her for lying. They didn't do any of that. Well, what was this Miss DiCuno? What the hell was she doing? Was she, in the immortal words of Brendan Sullivan, a potted plant? There's every evidence that the attorney was a potted plant, to be honest with you.
Well, I think the effect of this, James, Liz McGill at Penn was forced to resign. The president of Harvard got a reprieve. I'll tell you what bothers me, James, and I think those presidents really, as you said, what's that word you used? Whatever it was, it applies. And they did it. Buffonic. But what bothers me is driving those decisions to try to oust those presidents were self-styled arbiters of moral righteousness who are rich hedge fund, private equity, and politicians with a huge dose of hypocrisy. At Harvard, the loudest voice has been hedge fund guy Bill Ackman, who said that the president of Harvard was picked only because of her color. Thanks, Bill. He and his wife were associates of Jeffrey Epstein, the late sexual predator of young girls. At Penn, full disclosure, I teach a course there. Two of the McGill Must Go leaders were private equity billionaire Mark Rowan and former governor and ambassador John Huntsman. Both were Trumpites. Rowan as a big financial donor, Huntsman was a political appointee. Now, they're entitled to their opinion, totally. And I agree, McGill was slow on the uptake, both on Hamas originally and certainly she was flummoxed on Capitol Hill. But she's emphatically not an anti-Semite, and I don't think there's any indications that she has any bigotry. Contrast that with Rowan and Huntsman's guy, Trump. Did they demand he step down after he bragged that women love to be sexually assaulted by him, or when he belittled a person with disabilities, or questioned the judicial integrity of a judge just because of his Mexican ancestry, or acquitted demonstrators for taking down Confederate monuments with racist Ku Klux Klan bigots? You know, the Rowans, Huntsmans, and Axmans are associated with these universities, and it's their fault, Penn and Harvard, but they're associated only because they're big contributors. And maybe they have something to offer on the investing in the endowment or financing expansions or maybe even the football or rowing teams. But given their associations, why in the hell should we listen to them on issues of moral character or bigotry?
So we think of the current state of affairs in the Middle East, and we think of all of the things that we see. And I want to ask these gentlemen, use the term advisedly, and I would ask our listeners, just anybody, when you look at what's happening in the Middle East, who do you think is mostly to blame? A 19-year-old snot nose running around yelling river to the sea and colonialism, or the staggering, breathtaking negligence of the Israeli government headed by Benjamin Netanyahu that we now find was okaying hundreds of millions of dollars of payments directly to Hamas? I will pose the question, and I'll say up front, I don't have any evidence other than gut instinct. I wonder if BB didn't get his cut, all right? I just wonder. I can't imagine, just knowing his background and his ethics, that there were hundreds of millions of dollars being funded to somewhere right on the southern border where he didn't get his cut. But I'd be very clear, it's a supposition I have. But Mr. Ackerman and them, you keep on blaming these 19-year-olds, and please keep defending Bibi Netanyahu and the massive greed and incompetence of his government And for God's sakes, don't blame him. Blame the snot-nosed 19-year-old who has not even had a fully formed a political opinion. Or blame the president of Penn because she was incompetently prepped and gave a constipated testimony. But who are these people? What is wrong with people? Why can't they see right under their own noses what's going on? I wish just give me their side of what they're saying. And, you know, now, of course, it took them 8 hours to respond. It took us 3 minutes to respond. And I said something, and I want to correct this, that the failure of Israeli intelligence on October 7th, you know, was the biggest intelligence failure we had since 9/11. Actually, this was a much bigger intelligence failure than 9/11. 9/11 was colossal intelligence failure. Colossal. I mean, the August 6th memo, you can't imagine. This, the intelligence was much, much deeper. The payments, to my knowledge, you weren't authorizing direct payments to Al-Qaeda in, you know, June of 2021.
We were younger then.
Somebody, Bill Bart, asked somebody, if you bought it in 2021, how old would you be? He said 21.
You know, I want to tell our listeners out there, too. I think James's criticism of Netanyahu is absolutely on the mark. And James Carville has credentials. He has run political campaigns in Israel. So he knows the country. He knows the people. He's close to a number over there. And I just think your criticism is right on the mark. And I'm waiting for Mr. Rowan or Mr. Ackerman to comment on Bibi Netanyahu. I don't think we're going to hear it, James.
All right. Well, thank you. I know you. One thing, anybody that listens to the show, we don't mind disagreeing with each other.
We don't on this one. Okay. We're in agreement.
I know. Yeah, something.
You know, once you get off sports, they're not very many. They're occasional, but not very many. But we'll try to find more. All right, guys. Next week, we got a big show. I'm not going to tell you it now. We'll tease you later. But we'll have a big show next week. For the outrage of the week. James, you know, I really do understand that when employers facing slipping sales and profit sometimes find it necessary to let workers go. I hope they, you know, always do it with compassion. And I understand when executives add value for employers, communities, and shareholders, they should be well compensated. However, there is no justification for corporate CEOs making 344 times that of average worker pay. That's 17 times greater than it was in 1965. But what's really the most outrageous is when these two realities converge. Companies like Alphabet, Uber, Salesforce, Microsoft all laid off workers last year while giving raises to the already astronomical compensation of their top executives. Much a taxpayer's expense. This is Robin Hood in reverse and a lousy message over the holiday season.
So, if you can imagine, I've taken out sometimes an outrage, find something that I get really outraged about. I'm generally kind of conscious of it for the week leading up to the show. And some outrages are like everything else. There's gradations of outrages. Some of them we do. Today, the one you did was an excellent point. And sometimes, be frank, I mail it in every now and then. This outrage is so profoundly affected me, and I'm going to take a little time to share it with you. It has to do with Mike Johnson. Mike Johnson is always telling us about how holy he is in the Ten Commandments. Of course, I demonstrated beyond any shadow of a doubt that he violated the Ninth Commandment when he bore false witness against me, when he tweeted out publicly that I'd said Christianity was a greater threat to the United States than Al-Qaeda. Of course, I never said anything. Of course, I've never heard from him because, frankly, I think he's a human piece of shit. But I thought that. I now know it. I want to refer you to The Guardian, which is very, very well done. It's out of London, but it's got a huge following here in the United States, and it's a very high standard of journalism. As we know, Mike Johnson uses his teenage daughter and son as props for his war on women. I think it's putrid. I think it's disgusting. I think you're bringing great harm to your own children. You say that your wife had a pastoral counseling business. I've never heard. I'm sure she was trying to counsel people, anti-gay conversion therapy and anti-masturbation therapy and all the stupid shit that they try to do. But one thing that Mike Johnson also uses his dad as a prop, Patrick Johnson, and talked about him very movingly as he accepted the speakership. Patrick Johnson was a Shreveport firefighter. Now, bear with me a second here, because in the lore of labor, in the lore of liberal Louisiana, all 150 of us, he was a legendary labor leader who was, I'm sure people would say, was the most effective Southern labor leader when he was there, a man by the name of Vic Busey. He was well known around the country, and Vic was a Shreveport firefighter. And Pat in there is an ammunition dump. I get so upset about it, I literally can't talk about it. In a place called Minden, Louisiana, which is in the 4th Congressional District, and his dad and his wife, Janice, went to Mike Johnson's office to talk about Camp Minden, a military base where illegal munitions dumped, the largest in U.S. history, were located. Munitions had spontaneously exploded years before, causing a 4-mile blast radius. The pair drove to Mike Johnson's legal office late in the morning, Gabriel recalled, and Patrick Johnson explained to his son the immediate environmental and health dangers of a toxic dump boat. Pharma know that. They all studied that. They know toxic substances left and right. They're well trained. All right. Not only the residents in the immediate vicinity, but members of the Johnson family live in the region. His father and I went to him and said, Mike, you need to get involved. This is really important. Your family lives at ground zero. Gabriel said, and his family that he uses for his own political gain. And of course, his wife couldn't come to his swearing in as speaker because she had spent so much time on her knees. That's what he said. Okay. And praying. I don't have any doubt that that's what she was doing on her knees, was praying. And he said he wasn't interested. He had other things to do. He never was interested in environmental things. The couple left deeply disappointed. This is his daddy. His daddy honored our father and mother. All right. Gabriel, 72, has thought about this and failed to appeal Johnson repeatedly in recent years. This is not a good human being by any definition. And I'm never, ever going to give up. I'm going to come after you. I'm going to keep coming after you. I'm going to mock you. I'm going to ridicule you. I'm going to do everything to run your ass out of office. You are a disgrace to the state of Louisiana and to the United States of America. Period. End of story.
Carville v. Johnson. I know where my money is. Go at it, James.
Call Alice Starr and ask her how it ended, because it's going to end the same way for you.
And now for our listener questions from our really, really smart listeners, James. Margie in Colorado Springs probably asked my favorite one. She wonders if it's too late to have James run for president and have Charles Barkley as his vice president. They both tell it like it is. I suspect Charles will want to reverse that ticket, James.
Oh, of course. I mean, I would no way that I'd play second fiddle to the round mound of rebound. He's got such a winsome personality, you know. But I appreciate the thought. I think I'd know who would win the one-on-one basketball game.
Well, you could challenge him, though. No, you know, you could just, right. Just stand there.
He's had one of the best. I ran into Terry Bradshaw last week, I guess it was, when I was out in California. And, you know, Terry's had a very, very successful post-career in sports journalism. Charles has had enormously successful. I mean, he's just a great commentator. I actually ran into him at some, I don't know, steakhouse at the bar and shot the breeze with him for 40 minutes. And he's just, I love Charles Barkley. He's a real, real sports guy. He's a real engaging guy. He used to spout some of that goofy anti-tax shit, but I think he told me that Brother Russell gave him a little...
Right, it was when he was on the Axelrod show, and Bill Russell said, "You know who the hell paid for those, for, you know, that school in Leeds, Alabama, and who paid for all those recreational facilities, Charles? It was taxpayers' money from wealthier taxpayers. So shut up." Charles said, "I shut up after that."
I couldn't imagine Bill Russell say, "Tell me to do anything."
Exactly. I agree. Kent, we're in Colorado mode today, in Longmont, Colorado. Kent says, "I suspect if Democrats promised to keep the Trump tax cuts, many Republicans would happily switch their presidential votes. What do you think?" Kent, I love the fact you're a listener. That is an actively stupid idea on every level. Number one, if you keep the Trump tax cuts, you have deficits that anybody would worry about. It's amazing how much they cost. Secondly, if you think Republicans are going to think that the Democrats can outbid Republicans on tax cuts, Kent, no, won't happen. It's a bad idea. What they ought to do is keep the tax cuts for people making under a certain amount of money, reinstall the child tax credit, and do a couple other things and get rid of all those tax cuts and special benefits that went to wealthier taxpayers. That'd be in 2025.
Remember the guy, The Last Hurrah, which I think is one of the three greatest political novels ever written, that agreed with everything that Mayor Skeffington said, and they called him ditto. Well, ditto to what she said.
Exactly.
I'm in a mode of ditto. We're not disagreeing one iota.
Hey, James, John in Nashville, Tennessee says, this is a non-political question, but darn it, Skew, it affects everybody out there. "I'm old enough to remember when the phone rang, you picked it up. That was the way before cell phones and call waiting. Now I never answer a call without knowing who it is. I suspect most people, especially younger people, do the same. So how does a pollster get a large enough sample set of young people to respond to their poll?"
That's a good question. And I was talking to a very highly experienced pollster. You know, I think this is an interesting enough question that we should get, you know, a good pollster on. We used to do random digit dialing. Now you buy voter lists,
right?
Voter files. You do it from there, and you select the sample. They all say this is much better because of just the changes. And you know, I remember 15 years ago, and well, it's got, you know, 25% cell phone. What you would look for at a 50% cell phone is now God knows what. The point is, it's a very relevant question. And some of the media polls still do this, but my suggestion is we try pretty soon after the first of the year to get, of course, I'm associated with Stan Greenberg, and I think he's been doing this since the 70s. He actually has a PhD he taught at Harvard and got a PhD from Yale. He taught at Yale and had a PhD from Harvard. I've never been able to figure it out. It's all the same shit to me. But we know 10 people that can take us through the journey of sample drawing and questionnaires. And it's a sufficiently important subject coming into the election year that I think is worth
it. I do too. Stan would be one possibility. The other, if we want to do a twofer, is get Ann Selzer on before Iowa.
I'd be glad.
They both are great.
She's from Ashley, To be fair, our problem is not talented pollsters. Our problem is not particularly talented candidates.
We got a lot of Jim Gerstein, Fred Yang, Jeff Garin, and Peter Hart.
Jesus could go. And there are new people, John Angeloni. Yeah. But there are new people that are coming up, Pollock, I don't know. They people that have come up and that I just been out of the business for so long. But there aren't nobody we can pick. But we should do this because it's something that our listeners are interested in. And we're not, you know, we've been out, you know, you've probably conducted more media polls than any other human being. And the Wall Street Journal, you originated the Wall Street Journal poll, which remains the kind of gold standard of media polls, and Bloomberg polls, and Ann Salter. And to say that I've looked at polls for a long time, it would be an understatement.
Yeah. No, that's a good idea.
But I'm not current.
That's what happens when you get older, James. And I know because I'm older than you. Jeff in New Albany, Ohio says, I assume if Biden were replaced, big assumption, by a younger, more electable candidate, Harris would not be at the top of the ticket and probably be bumped. How can you replace Joe and bump Kamala without exacerbating the voting engagement problem with the young and people of color? Well, I'll tell you, Jeff, in that hypothetical example, if it were to happen, Kamala only would be bumped by the voters. She would get in there, and if she wins South Carolina and wins Michigan and wins a number of other primaries, she'll be the nominee. If she gets defeated in those primaries, I think you have a good candidate. I don't think you can say that Kamala was given a raw deal. So I'm less worried about that than I might otherwise be.
Well, I was having a conversation with a highly regarded within the profession and very highly regarded by me, who said something utterly stupid to me. And that is, well, if we don't go with Biden and we throw it open, how do you know that we'll nominate some pro-Palestinian candidate? You know, to understand this, the left, the far left, has fielded candidates in the Democratic Party, and they all have something in common that don't even come close, right? And so this new excuse that we can't get rid of Biden because if you do, you run the risk of Penn students determining the outcome of the process. That is the lamest answer I've ever heard in my life. And to be fair to me, I told the person who told me that what I thought of the idea. I think very highly of this person, but that's about the intellectual depth that this thing is getting probed.
Sounds more like a James Comer question, doesn't it? We have a question now from Alec in Kennesaw, Georgia. You know, he's worried about the ever-changing Georgia Congressional Six, but he also wants to know if Democrats have already lost the presidential election in that state.
Well, they never already lost anything. All right. And Georgia is essential and key. Battleground state, you know. Shit, we're behind Michigan. All right, which we won by more than Georgia, Arizona, or Wisconsin, or Pennsylvania, or Nevada. So right now, yeah, but if we get some kind of excitement, and, you know, Georgia's got a slew, a lot of black voters and more coming because Georgia's one of the few states that's got a lot of black in migration. Right. There's a lot of young voters in Georgia. You know, lots of them in the Atlanta Metroplex. And we're not doing very well with either one. And, you know, right now we're careening toward a disaster. But, you know, you can pull a plane out of a deep dive sometimes.
Yeah, let's hope. Stephen in Scranton, Pennsylvania asks,
Lackawanna County, know it well, man.
Let's hypothetically say Trump wins. What is currently in place that prevents Trump from continuing to be president beyond the standard 4 years? Stephen, that doesn't worry me one bit, and I'll tell you why. If he's elected, he'll do so much damn damage in 4 years that by 2028, we may not even have a presidential election. People just don't appreciate the damage that Trump can do, especially if he carries a Republican Congress in with him, but even without that.
Yeah, his biggest obstacle, let's assume that he wins, all right? His biggest obstacle is the actuarial tables. Okay, that's just what it is. You look at that guy. That is one unhealthy specimen. He doesn't have a particularly impressive family history. He's got terrible lifestyle habits. How fat do you think that guy is right now? I don't think he's seen his penis in this century. I really don't. I mean, look at that gut. But that's my view.
James, I'm going to tell an anecdote. I agree with you, but there was a congressman from New Jersey, Eddie Patton, who was about 5'10", weighed about 270 pounds, and he was in the men's room outside the house one time, and he was fumbling. He was having a hard time, and Don Edwards said to him, "You know, Eddie, what's wrong?" And Eddie said, "I can't find it." And Don said, "That must be hell when you're making love." And Eddie said, "No, there's two of us looking for it then." Oh my god,
you know, next time you see somebody said there's you know, Miss Johnson, she taught me the second grade, she's 90 years old, I want to go over and tell her hello, and there's old man such and such, and you know, he was a former policeman, he's 90 years old, you know what I can tell you that neither these two people have in common? They're not fat.
Yeah. And okay. Donald Trump is fat. Also, James, to go to your point.
No, he's not fat. He's, I think he's obese, morbidly obese, maybe. He just lies about his weight. So it was like 216.
He also, for all the talk about Biden's age, we should not forget the fact that if Trump is elected, he will spend the majority of a term, if he lives, in his 80s. All right, last question. God, there's so many good ones today. John in Chicago says, if he becomes president and is convicted of any of his 91 indictments, how can the House of Representatives not impeach him? Do you think that the Supreme Court would rule on this? I think every Supreme Court justice except Thomas would have to side with the Constitution and not allow Trump to pardon himself.
Wait, but to pardon... The question was on impeachment.
What John is saying is, if Trump is elected president and he's been convicted of a crime, would the House of Representatives then impeach him, and would the Supreme Court rule on this because he would try to pardon himself? And I don't know if that's ever been adjudicated.
Just a lot. If I was like a law student, you know, does impeachment require crime? I think the Constitution just says high crimes and misdemeanors. It has to be something related to his office. I don't know. It's a good question, and you know, we'll try to ask around and get a better answer. But right now, a lot of shit's spinning through my head, but I just don't.
Well, I'll make a commitment, James. You and I can. One of our guests on a show in the next couple of weeks is going to be Pam Karlan, the great Stanford law professor and former Justice Department official.
The law dean,
isn't she? Yeah, and we can ask Pam.
She'll give us the right answer.
Okay, keep those. Yeah,
that's a good idea.
Keep those questions coming because they are so good, and I apologize for the ones we don't get to. We'll try to get to them next week. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Real Paper, Miracle Made, and Lomi, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them because when you do, you help make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. You also can find other shows you might enjoy in the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. And remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.